Question? Yes. Hi. This is for I guess the whole non-rebuildable topic. Again, maybe out of scope, but what would you do, let's say once the building, let's say a building comes down, earthquake or whatever, and it's a non-rebuildable lot, what would you do with it? With the lot?
I know some people that the plan is to turn them into parking lots, self-storage units, anything that's not considered real estate, meaning it doesn't have a foundation and it is movable. You can do that as long as you're not getting in trouble with the neighbor or the municipality, but you turn it into something a bit more creative. And in many cases, you just try to sell it to somebody else who will do that if you're not in the mood to do it yourself. But maybe somebody else knows more.
Yeah, so just so people know about the question, there are some rules, like some buildings, you cannot rebuild them. Okay. You can't get permits to rebuild. It must stay like a 1970s building. So what happens is people do renovations. You can renovate the hell out of them, but you cannot rebuild it. The question is, if that burns down or comes down in an earthquake, for example, what do you do? Because you cannot rebuild a new property there. Usually the access is very, very narrow as well. So you can't turn it like into a really a parking lot. The reasons for that. But I think there is still within scope, you may be able to renovate it to like still renovate within a acceptable means of the ward to say, oh yeah, this is a renovation, not a rebuild. But yeah, although they are with the new regulations, I'm not sure how true that would be. But that is one of the risks when buying these no rebuild allowed properties. And that's why for most of my clients, we don't touch them. Banks won't finance it. And my thing I always say is, what if it burns down? What are you going to do? Realistically, though, if it does burn down, maybe only a portion is damaged enough. Similarly, in an earthquake, it's not just going to go boom, straight down. It'll be damaged to a degree. And I think that's fixable in most likely.
Right, and assuming it does go and burn completely to the ground, again, parking lot is an idea. Sell to the next house over.
Neighbors
I see.
For rent.
That's a really good idea, actually. Yeah. Sell it to somebody who wants to expand. I know that we are sitting on the house that we're living in now and constantly looking at what the neighbors are doing because we want to expand. That's a very viable strategy, if not always possible. But yes. Yes, please go ahead.
Are any of you investing in leasehold, and how do you run the numbers for that?
Oh, no, I'm not a fan of leasehold at all. But leasehold, so again, for people who don't know, we have often most properties are freehold, but there are some properties that are leasehold where you have a 20 or 30-year lease on the land. And certain, like the old laws, you're able to, the old contracts, you can renew them and you pay a monthly rental fee and a renewal fee every like 20 or 30 years. There are some new lease agreements where after 30 years, you have to hand the property back. And that's it. You don't get it. A common example is the one in front of Tokyo American Club, in front of TAC. TAC own that building in front, and you have like a 30-year leasehold. At the end of it, you're just going to give it back.
There's something I did. Sorry, so I didn't understand something for ages. You just maybe clarified it for me. The old leasehold, meaning you can renew it
Yeah,
after the,
freehold.
yeah. But does that mean that the landlord has to renew it for you, or only if they agree?
I know that I think they kind of have to. In the same way that, like with regular rental lease, they can't evict you from the or they can't refuse rental.
I need to have a really good reason to.
And off like that reason, the one that I've heard is if the building is not really livable or unsafe, right? But you as the leasehold owner need to maintain that building.
What about if I was running a nightclub and I'm really noisy?
No, I don't. I think that's not. Yeah, no, that's not an issue with the building
Not
itself.
eligible, so you can call the cops on me, but he can't not renew my lease because of that.
You know what? I can't give you a clear answer on that one.
Okay.
It, perhaps if it's, it depends on what the original contract would be written, is what I would assume. And I don't know if using it inappropriately in like outside a certain category is going to be a violation of that or not.
So kind of similar to a normal rental lease, essentially, except for 30 years, and yeah.
Yes. And those lease agreements are quite old and only like 2 or 3 pages. Yeah.
Yeah, but there's, I think there's a lot. I have a friend who has a lot, who has, his family has had a leasehold for over 70 years in Xinghua, and the amount that they're actually paying for the use of their land is incredibly cheap because maybe the laws, restrict how much they can increase the price. And the landowner keeps coming to him and saying, oh, won't you buy the land? Won't you buy the land? Because he's probably gotten into an inheritance situation since his parents passed away. So I'm thinking maybe there's some opportunity to, I mean, if the population is declining and you have people all over the country just saying, what am I going to do with this property that I inherited from my parents? I'm not interested in it. Maybe there is an opportunity to buy that out.
Well, so there's two parts to that question. One is a lot of these akia are inheritance properties that people don't want. You know, I've even had relative's cousin on the Japanese side inherited some land in, I don't even remember which prefecture it was. And they were offering to the different relatives, who wants it? I'm like, yeah, no, I checked it up on Google. I even downloaded all the title and the title documentation and stuff. I don't want to deal with this lot of land. It's got trees and it's mostly forestry. I don't want to touch it. So I left it. And I think that is definitely a big issue with inheritance. That's different to, now you're talking about leasehold. Some of the benefits of leasehold is you don't pay the asset tax. That's held by the landowner. So you don't pay fixed asset tax, only on the building, not the land, which is where majority of it is. So if you have a great deal where the rent is so low on it, and the rent is actually less than the fixed asset tax, then the landowner is paying, is just losing money on this landlord, right? Yeah, but yeah, so it really depends on the agreement. But there's a situation I can imagine where the rental is cheaper than owning. And in that case, just keep renting it if you are never going to be evicted.
Yeah, exactly. I want to add on to that. There's so many different type of leasehold. You really have to read the agreement itself. A lot of time is in the center of Tokyo, very, very good locations. They are still leasehold. The reason it being a leasehold for so many years, 100 years, because the paperwork to convert it to dividable land is so hard. There's so many paperwork to do, and we don't even know who the descendant is. So in that case, it can stay in leasehold forever. But there's also specialists you can hire to go after all the descendant to get them sign the paper and finally become a piece of land and can be go on sale. There's a different type of leasehold. It really depends on the agreement itself. Yeah, there's specialists for that.
They're so old and they're so all over the board. There's no like standard form.
Yeah, sometimes it could be owned by like a temple. Those tend to be like a big landlord. Those type of lands really hard to kind of make them up for sale. They can just be leasehold forever. Typically, it's renewed like 20 years or 30 years term. And also, each time is negotiable. You can make it even longer. So it really just depends on the owner, the landlord itself.
The one thing you want to keep in mind with, you know, I always talk about financing and loans. A lot of banks won't finance for leasehold, or if they do, they'll only finance for the remaining portion of the lease. So let's say it's a 30-year lease and there's 18 years left. Instead of being able to get a 35-year loan, they'll only give you an 18-year loan term for it. Even if they know you can renew, the duration will be 18 years. So in general, the two big properties that I always avoid with my clients will be the no rebuild allowed and leasehold.
Yeah, but some of leasehold could be, oh, sorry. So you really have to read the agreement. Some of the leasehold will say if the change of the owner of the building, this leasehold also terminates. So it's really depends on specific agreement.
The 10% name transfer fee, 10% of the sale price is just a fee to the landowner to transfer the name.
One more thing to remember is if the lease is not renewed for any reason, you as the owner of the structure are responsible for the cost of demolition and removal. If that's a big concrete building, that's going to be a lot of money. So that's something to keep in mind. Any other questions, hands, people at the microphone? Yes. Yeah, go for it.
First one isn't necessarily a question, but a nice comment. I just wanted to say thank you. It has been a great event and have loved hearing from all the presenters, especially around connecting with the community and giving back.
Thank you, streamers.
Hey.
Thanks, Mom.
I don't know if this is a two-part question because it's might be two unrelated, but any insights on buying properties in Fukuoka versus Tokyo? Is there a high price premium for new properties versus old properties? And I'm going to stop it there because there's a lot of questions.
I can talk about Fukuoka for hours on end. We live there. It's where we have done most of our business when it was still a lot cheaper. It's not now, it's closer to Osaka level, so it's not as cheap. There are advantages with the tenant base and the character of the city. It's a very family-oriented city on the one hand, very startup-oriented on the other hand. The mayor has been doing a very good job positioning, or at least in theory, positioning Fukuoka as Japan's startup hub. Although I think really most of the startup activity happens around Tokyo, but Fukuoka is lower cost of living, lower cost of business upkeep. A lot of people move there, and it's a fantastic place to live. So yes, it's a very vibrant, one of the most vibrant. Actually, during the pandemic, Fukuoka was the only city that kept creeping upwards, not like continuously gaining like it did before the pandemic. But even when Tokyo and Osaka went flat because of the pandemic, Fukuoka was still creeping upwards. Probably as good a fundamentals as Tokyo and Osaka, except it has a little bit more room to grow, definitely compared to Tokyo. On the other topic, I'll let the rest of you answer.
My thoughts on that question are, I've never heard someone say compare Fukuoka and Tokyo. It's completely different. Where do you want to live, or where do you want to be? It's not one or the other. Like,
I think it was asked about an investment. Like all past this as an investment destination, I think.
Yeah, there's a lot of questions. The same thing. So. For sure, this one was related at the same person. So, for short-term or monthly rentals, any insight on the age of property that gives the best return? The age of
property. That's a lot. That's a lot of questions. So, it depends on where you are. So, age. Older is better in places like Kyoto. For me, I get a really good return on sort of the older places here, like the Showa, the daggy places that that Japanese people don't want to rent, because I find it hard to get a landlord who will rent to me and let me do a licensing. So, but if there is a Showa era property that, it's pretty daggy, I can do a lot with leaning into that and leaning into the classic nature and putting some vintage textiles on the wall. But it does come down to location. I've got some stuff in Yoyogi that sells really well that no one wants to rent as a chintai, because it's just not pretty, but location and what I've done with it in terms of the textiles. Yeah. Design.
I'm going to continue reading questions from the stream. So if you have questions, please line up.
There was a monthly question in there as well. Monthly needs to be okay. The monthly rentals is a different market that really does need to be very practical because people are here for 1 to 3 months, so it does need to have a lot of sort of nice practical amenities. So. I'll just leave it there.
So in terms of the Kyoto market, there's two factors with the age. Obviously, people are looking for the charm of the properties, which I think Siv commented on. And the other one is that if you go earlier than 1950, you get the regulatory benefits. So there's more relaxed regulation to operate in Kyoto. So there's benefits from that. It's the Machiya properties.
Neil's putting up to give me some of this time on this question, but is there ever seller financing in Japan? This is a super common model in the West, and I never hear about it. I'd love to hear your comments on that.
Because they have different...
Yeah, so I'll kind of repeat the answer that I gave earlier when we were talking privately. Yeah, seller financing where basically the seller will let you pay them back, almost give you a mortgage and let you pay them back over time. We don't have that model really in Japan. I don't know why. I've never seen it. I've never heard anyone even talk about it. I do feel it is because there could be some regulations about issuing a mortgage. You need to be a bank to get, or a regulated and see to give mortgages. There could be taxation issues that perhaps the loans that an individual give, the interest charged on that is not tax deductible as a business expense. I can imagine a whole bunch of rules and regulations that Japan has that doesn't make that a viable option. If it were, I may have heard about it, but it's never something that anyone talks about unless you're American and I get that question. Oh, yes.
More feedback. Give the other experts a chance to comment.
I have handled a sale where the seller was the bank and the mortgage was easy to arrange. We did it ourselves and put it on the title. The seller basically took a series of payments over 5 years and had a mortgage on the property the whole time. It was good for the buyer because the buyer could start depreciating the property straight away. It was good for the seller because of a personal reason, but the problem for the seller, which he didn't think about at the time, was that his capital gains payment was due at the start before he got much money from the buyer. But that was all handled in the end.
Thank you. Exactly. Yeah. That's what I'm going to add. For commercial deals, there's definitely room for negotiations to structure the deals. Like this gentleman just mentioned.
Gentlemen, can you just 1 second come back to the mic and quickly introduce yourself? He's very low-key, but he's extremely knowledgeable. Now I know a little bit more about him. Please tell us who you are.
My name is Jason King, and I've run for 25 years a real estate company in Hokkaido.
Thank you.
Thanks, yeah.
I mean, a bit of a different direction, but I'm just, like, I'm one of the newer guys to the whole IKEA space. And thank you for all your time and the presentation as well. But I was wondering, do you have any resources? You're all from different fields, but like any resources you can recommend, such as books for someone new getting into the field that you think are great to read? Books. And how much is it books? How much is reading and how much is it doing? And that's also...
Well, what there...
Yeah. Yeah. That I can have. Okay. Thank you. I mean,
he's not here, but Anton has written the book. Yeah, I read it. It's great. Yeah. And he recommends, pretty much everyone's here's services as well. So that's really good resources.
And then there's what's his name, Alex Kerr. Do you know he's the Kominka car? Is that it? That's kind of like related. The Kominka. I haven't read any of his stuff. I just know because I'm scratching my head trying to think of something other than Anton's book. Is he okay? Yeah, I don't really know the guy.
Yeah.
I feel now like an event like this, you see people like, Anton was here yesterday. He's not here. But Shu as well and Akihab. It's no longer books. So much. They have whole videos and programs that you can subscribe to or just watch, and the hours of DIY sort of stuff, them actually doing it or doing the walkthrough. So you are going through that journey.
Yeah, well, I'm quite curious about, like, I read a lot of books, but what is the best approach getting into it? Is it buying and just start getting going, or maybe watching videos? Like, what is
it?
All right, fair enough.
Thank you.
Okay, all right.
Write a book.
One more from the
screen. Actually, just before you get onto that. I know Anton has sometimes events at his property in like in Chiba where you can go. You went to that. Where you basically go and help him. He does like a workshop. And you go and help sort of like clean his house in Chiba. And Seth, you went to that. You experienced that.
We went to the Chiba farmhouse, and he put a video on YouTube. I did a lot of weed whacking and a lot of swimming, but it was fun. Yeah. I got like a cool coin. So,
So I think if you want to experience it without putting the money in, then there are people you can reach out to like Anton to say, hey, you need some help doing this. I went to his open house the other day, and if you want to help like build his thing, he's definitely a good guy to talk to. Otherwise, buy your own through someone like you.
What are the new regulations that Emil mentioned regarding non-rebuilds?
Blanca, I think, did a whole presentation on that. So you can watch Blanca's one from yesterday. Oh, do you want to just touch on that very briefly? Nope. Okay, watch your one.
It's literally about a structural work. So and it's regarding the buildings that are wooden structure, two floors, 200 square meters and more. Right now, you're going to need permissions. You're going to need all different kind of plans from architects and permission from the city hall to actually be able to renovate, which you did not need until now. So yeah, we did a whole about a 45 minutes presentation on that yesterday. So it would be best to look that up.
Can I start? Any information on buying or making parking lots?
Yeah, hang on, just one second. Blanca, how you as a renovation company, if you answer that, I'm sorry, I had to keep running around. Mm-hmm. How much has that increased your overhead and prices because you now have to comply with that legislation?
Not yet, because I'm still finishing up the things I started before April 1st. So, and then my next three projects don't have that issue.
Roughly,
it will be okay. I was talking about it yesterday. It's about 500,000 start if you have to start with all the paperwork. It doesn't go up to me. It goes towards the client. If it's a older house that doesn't have any of the paperwork, you are easily looking even around ¥1 million, because there's going to be a lot of paperwork that will have to be submitted.
Okay, so
starting at ¥500,000 extra,
potentially
more.
Okay, and then
parking lots.
Yeah, parking lot. Any information?
We've looked at them on behalf of a bunch of clients. From what I've understood during all of those research and reviews, and maybe somebody else can comment more from their experience, but there are, if it's a single level parking lot, meaning you just turn your asphalt, a bit of a land plot, and turn it into a parking lot, even if it's on an hourly basis, which is a lot better than the monthly ones, 2% at best, because you have to buy a large plot of land and it has to be in a fairly central location to be profitable. So obviously the price is going to be higher. If it's out in the sticks, maybe monthly rental, you're going to get maybe 2% if you're lucky. Most people, if they do that for land banking, meaning they want to sit on that until the land gains in value. And this is a way of covering costs and maybe making a smidgen more. If you turn it into a multi-level parking lot with a boom gate, et cetera, then it can become a profitable endeavor. But then your maintenance costs will go up and the hassle of dealing with it will go up. If it's a single level, you just need to renew the asphalt once in a while. It's pretty much zero maintenance. And once you go multi-story, then you're turning it into a bit of a business. Anybody else has experience with those at all? No. Okay. We did see recently a property in Tokyo, a ground floor of a building where you could just buy that parking lot, right? And rent out three. You own it via title deed. It's not an actual lot. It's a part of the building, like a garage. And that bit of the property was sold individually. Normally, the units come with a rentable parking lot that the owner union owns. But in some cases, you could just, apparently, I've never seen it before, but you would apparently just buy the building's garage. It fitted three cars. It seemed like fairly decent rental income comparable with any other unit, but much lower maintenance and tenant hassle. So maybe interesting, but there's not many of them out there.
It's a follow-up question to the seller financing, but is subject to a concept here in Japan, doing a financing deal subject to mortgage. Essentially, the buyer assumes payment of the mortgage, but the seller transfers the title.
Sorry, can you just repeat the question once more?
Is the in the US, there is a concept of doing a subject to deal, which means the buyer or the seller transfers the title to the buyer, and the buyer is continuing to pay the mortgage. Mortgage is held under the seller's name.
So we play.
So earlier I said I've never experienced seller financing. It's something I rarely hear of.
So we do a lot in the U.S. Actually, yeah. I've done so many. Yeah. That's so cool. That feels right, because right now in the chair.
But yeah, I know. Just before he continues to speak, in general, what happens is on settlement day, that's when the buyer, the title transfers and the mortgage, I guess the seller's mortgage goes on that onto the title. So everything happens on settlement day when the title changes hands and the mortgage is issued.
There's no new mortgage, basically. I'm giving you cash. I'm buying you out, but I'm going to continue on.
Oh, the existing, the bank.
The seller can't have a mortgage at the time of the purchase. The seller has to own the property without a mortgage.
The way it works.
So making a mortgage is easy. For example, I lent some money to an employee of mine to buy his house. And just for the exercise, my tuck-in, my licensee, went to the various organizations and registered the mortgage without using any other scrivener or lawyer, just so we could learn how to do it. For this sale, the person who sold the property owned it outright without a mortgage. On the day that the settlement happened, he transferred the title of the property to the buyer, and the mortgage was triggered on the property so that the seller held a mortgage on the property so that if the buyer had defaulted any of the next 5 years of payments, the property would have reverted back to the seller. After the 5 years of payments were done, we then got both the buyer and the seller to sign another document to release the mortgage.
The question may have been that if there was not a free and clear house.
Yeah.
If there wasn't, it's a no-go anyway.
You can't give a mortgage on, you can't, the existing, because the title changes, the previous mortgage must be paid out if there is one.
Yeah, I think there's a few, mortgages have been said a few times, I think in a slightly different context. One of them is the bank, like a loan from a bank. That mortgage is written on there. Then it was also said the term mortgage was, you know, when he had the mortgage on it, it's the mortgage lien under the individual's name, under Jason's name. So if a bank has the mortgage lien on the title, then the only way the bank will allow you to release that is if you pay off the bank loan completely. So in the situation where there was some flexibility with that, when it was an individual that held it without a bank mortgage lien on there, and they were able to sell it, and that individual became the mortgagee, put the mortgage lien on the title.
That's true.
Look, I think in most transactions, you just don't deal
with that. This was a deal for a special purpose, but there can be multiple mortgages on a property. I'm not a lawyer, but there can be multiple mortgages on a property which are prioritized according to who was first.
Yeah,
who was first?
Yeah, but a lot of banks, most properties, the banks will say, "Look, if this is the situation, we don't want to deal with it."
The banks will only handle the first mortgage; they won't handle it, subsequent mortgages.
Subject to is a typical strategy we employ in the US, where, because right now the interest rate is like 6 or 7%, right? Yeah. So when we buy the house, we also buy the seller's mortgage, the seller's loan. We take them together. If the seller's loan is like 2 or 3%, that's the kind of strategy we play right now. So when I tried in Japan, it just didn't work. I couldn't find any bank would allow me to assume a mortgage, because by doing that way, I can just keep getting all the good rates, right?
Yeah.
Explore that strategy we use in the US here, but it just didn't work out, unfortunately.
Yeah.
But it's typically used in the US. We do the subject to deals or just assumable mortgage loan deals.
I want to say first, thank you guys. It's really exciting to hear from all of you. We hear a lot about Tokyo. We hear about Osaka and Kyoto. I'm curious, any information or thoughts on investments maybe west of Tokyo to some of the larger cities like Shizuoka, Hamamatsu, Nagoya?
Yep.
I'd love to hear.
We do that constantly. So the first thing to look at is obviously population trends. We don't have the 2025 population census yet. It'll be out in October. But as of the 2020 population census, I can point to Fukuoka, which we've discussed, Kumamoto City, central Yokohama. Suburban Yokohama can be very suburban. So central Yokohama is good. Chiba City, stable population. Saitama City, if you want to stay around Tokyo. I've heard, I found out recently, I didn't bother to check because I thought Kobe was such a, you know, nice city. I keep hearing good things. I thought population was kept rising, but apparently 2015 to 2020, the population has actually gone into stagnation. I'm hoping by 2025, Kobe would be an option again. Sapporo comes and goes. Population is stable slash stagnant slash slightly declining, but it's one of Japan's biggest cities, so I definitely wouldn't rule it out. Nagoya is stable population, but very blue collar. So you do have occasional late payment, you know, tenant absconding issues, a little bit more than in other parts of Japan. And Kyoto, if you can find investment properties in Kyoto that are not traditional short-term stay properties, if you're looking for that, then we snatch a deal whenever we see it, but there's not that many coming out of there that's not more within Chai's expertise. Otherwise, prefectural capitals, I would look again, look at the population trends, but anywhere that's the biggest city in an otherwise rural prefecture, Takamatsu and the other one on Shikoku are a sample of that, even though the population there is also kind of stagnant. And satellite communities. So I'm expecting that we'll see at least a little bit of an increase in satellite community populations when the 2025 census come out, because even though the pandemic didn't have a huge effect on remote working here like it did in the rest of the world, still there has been some movement out of bigger city centers. So I think some people, maybe definitely a lesser extent, but I'm assuming some people have found the joy of living out of the bigger cities during the pandemic. That might be something to look at closer when the census comes out.
If you're looking at Shizuoka, Matt and I, we went to Makinohara, and over there, like, the local government is really interested in getting foreign investors and people buying properties there and kind of revitalizing the area. So, you know, around Shizuoka, the Makinohara, they are very, very open to get new investors. So you can look at that.
I would say if you find spots like that where you can see that the government, which is rare in Japan, right, that the municipal government is actually actively encouraging people with actual initiatives, not just putting it down as a policy, but actually taking action to try, like Fukui Prefecture, for example, have been amazing. They came to the, which is a very rural area, they came to the Gaijin Pot Expo. They had a giant booth. They gave out gifts. They say, hey, come over to Fukui. And places like that, even if they're not growing in population yet, are probably some of the rare gems that will eventually be attractive for investment destinations. So I would highlight them. And if there's any continued efforts to rejuvenate the area, I would definitely look at those locations. Of the prefectural capitals that I've mentioned, Kumamoto has been doing very well because of the TSM giant chip plant that was built there, drawing interest from overseas, bringing in a lot of immigrants, which tend to have, on average, more children than your typical Japanese native family. So Kumamoto is definitely an interesting place. Transactions have picked up very significantly. Their prices, not so much yet, so probably a good place to hit.
Another question from the stream. I think you mentioned it a little bit, touched on it a little bit. Opinions on Nagoya. Is it growing or stagnant? Audible sigh.
I don't know, man. Like, something tells me that something's gonna go, like, bound to go on there. Like, kind of, like, I'm really bullish on Shizuoka right now, and like basically the coast along, basically the Tokaido line between, call it like Atami and Nagoya, which to me suggests that at some point Nagoya should hit it off. I don't know how and when, but I'm definitely watching it, but I don't know what to watch for. But I don't know, I get a vibe or something. Like,
is the maglev cancellation, yeah, going to, because the maglev's been cancelled now, so is that going to affect things?
Like the whole damn thing?
Destroyed so many, yeah, properties along the train tracks, right? That put a bit of pressure on the city center, but yeah, but then the pandemic took it down again, so
Well, and the guy that was being the stick in the mud for the maglev is out now. So, but yeah, who knows what, I don't know if it, I think it's just been killed. I'm not following it too closely. It's very sad. It would have been amazing.
It's one of the biggest.
Yeah.
Nagoya is one of the biggest cities in Japan. Population numbers are good. It's got versatile industries, although again, most of them are industrial and blue collar. There's definitely a healthy tenant base there. a little bit more challenging to deal with, but it's still Japan. It's not like ghettos and crime labs, you know, it's drug labs. It's just a blue collar city. We have customers investing in Nagoya and will continue to do so. It's just, it requires a bit more management, but prices and yield are good. And like Matt, I do think that something will happen in that area eventually.
You know, actually this is related, but I'm going to have to explain a little bit. Recently I got, a request about, Ito in Izu. And basically what they were saying is, yo, I keep going to Ito and I'm seeing like some pretty good stuff. Why the hell isn't anybody buying here? What's going on? And I was curious. I mean,
our customers are, but just holiday homes, not investment.
Yeah. And so I was like, oh yeah, actually I see that thing. Like, what's going on here? Why is it not? I feel like it should pop off, but it's not. Like, Right.
Get that mic. No, just saying, I helped a client recently buy something in Ito as well. And I looked there maybe 7 years ago, and that was one of the things. A lot of the properties had like the Sento water. You have to like pay billing, transfer that over. You got to pay management fees when you're actually part of a community.
Yeah, it's all resortish there.
Yeah, it's all resortish. And there, you can't do Airbnb. There's just so many rules. Yeah, which is good for the locals, but
right.
It has the vibe of that it was really good in the 80s and 90s.
Like, yeah, there's plenty of abandoned bubble era concrete mansions on the hill there.
I saw a really nice house on top of the hill. It was tough to get up to, but it was like 15 million yen, and it was just gorgeous. It was like, it looked like a $1 million house at one point, but it was like $4,500 a year to run. And it came with free lands. Like, here, look at here. If you buy this property, you also get this big chunk of land over here. I'm like, but I'm going to have to pay for that, right?
Yeah.
So it's 9,000 to keep the property. And it was like, wow, I want this house, but
that's a good
bit. You know, so there's a lot of things like that. And that's because Izu is gorgeous.
Yeah.
It's like one of the best areas in Honshu.
Yeah, it's a beautiful area. But yeah, like we've run across resort regulations and stuff like that too. Yeah. Well, we're going to have to call it, folks. We have 30 minutes of photo ops. Emil, your photo didn't work due to a corrupt file. So we're going to give you a chance to do it one more time. So give Emil the selfie again, please. Thank you very much. Thank you to our experts and our newly found experts. Thank you. I think some of you will unfortunately have to not remain so low-key in future events. We'll see how we go. Thank you very much, yes, for our audio-visual team. And everyone on the stream, yes. Thank you as well for joining and chiming in with questions. We appreciate you continuously. One more photo up.